Welcome to The Locked Room, stories from the golden age of mystery and crime fiction. I'm Mardell, and this week's story is The Scent of Almonds by Hulbert Futner. General Southam, the president of the Allegheny system, was waiting for Madame Story and me on the wharf at Stockmar, Georgia. Tall, gray, and distinguished, he looked the part of the great tycoon, as few of them do. Such a man doesn't give much away in his face, but I could see a look of strain and anxiety there that suggested we had difficult work ahead of us. He and my employer were old friends, and at the sight of her, his grim face lighted up. "Rosica, you take a man's breath away," he said. "How can I talk seriously to you?" Madame Story filled her lungs with the balmy breath of the sea. "It is actually spring down here," she said, smiling. "Must you be serious?" The shadow came back into his face. "I must," he said. He had a super motorboat lying alongside the wharf that was good for 60 miles an hour or something preposterous, and we set off in it with a shattering roar. General Southam jumped up and waved his arms at the operator. "I told you I wanted to go back slowly," he said when he could make himself heard. "I'll let you know when to open her up." The man throttled down his engine with a rather sulky air because, naturally, he wanted to show off his boat to the beautiful lady. Then we could hear ourselves talk. We were seated side by side in the stern, Madame Story in the middle. "This will be our only chance to talk together privately," said General Southam. "The clubhouse is like a goldfish bowl, and of course, none of them must suspect that you are here for any but purely social reasons. Miss Brickley must be introduced not as your secretary, but your friend." Madame Story lit a cigarette. "Well, what am I here for?" she asked, smiling. "It has nothing to do with crime." "Good," she exclaimed. "Ever since I hung out my shingle as a practicing psychologist, I've been waiting for somebody to engage me to straighten out the human tangles that result in crimes, but they always call me in after the crime has been committed." She smiled in my direction. "Bella and I are sick of crime." General Southam looked at her, startled. "Oh, not crime," he said quickly, "but you'll find your tangle waiting for you over yonder," he grimly added, waving his hand to indicate Mickle Island, lying like a cloud on the sea outside. After a silence, he suddenly asked, "Do you know Win Bucknell?"
"I've heard of him," said Madame Story.
"A very remarkable fellow. Already, at 32, he's vice president in charge of operations on the Allegheny, and everybody regards him as my eventual successor. And he's more than a mere railway executive. He has everything. Like most men of capacity, he's extraordinarily attractive to women." "Ah," said Madame Story dryly. "In New York, I often have him at my house," the general went on, "so that we can discuss the affairs of the road in quiet. I never thought of the danger, but, well, it has happened." He spread out his hands rather piteously. "My girl, my Elsie. Nobody else would ever guess it, but I know. A reticent child, she's only 18, you know, and I am afraid one of the desperate, quiet natures that only once, you know, once and for all time." The general stopped and blew his nose as a cover for his feelings. Presently he went on more firmly. "In New York, Wynne, with his crowding engagements and with all the lovely ladies setting their caps at him, scarcely noticed my girl. So I laid my harmless little plot. I asked him to join us here at the island, on the pretext that it was necessary for us to formulate a program of economy for the road,
I trusted to the influences of spring. In these lovely surroundings, he stopped again. Didn't it work out? Asked Madame Story. It started off all right. It was late in the season, and the other members drifted north to Pinehurst and White Sulphur, leaving us alone at the club. Wynne was struck, and struck hard. It was delightful to see him suddenly becoming aware of my girl and paying his court, and to see the shine in her eyes that she concealed so well. After having planned it all, you can understand how happy it made me. And then, that damned woman turned up.
What woman?
Layla Dean.
Oh, said Madame Story, but in a different tone from before. A week ago, she came with her father, the general resumed. You know, he's Levitt O'Malley, the celebrated criminal lawyer. He's a member of the Mickle Island Club, and of course they have as much right here as I have. She is obviously in pursuit of Wynne Bucknell. I don't know what there may have been between them, but everything for us is spoiled now. Wynne is a changed man. And when I see my little girl's bleak face, and her determination to show the world that she doesn't care, I can't tell you. He turned away his head. There's something about that woman, he went on in a low, savage voice, something that appeals to what is base in us. I've told you how it is with Wynne. He seems to be enslaved. I feel it myself. I am attracted and repelled. By God, I can understand how a man might... He suddenly became ashamed of his violence and tried to pass it off. Well, never mind, but it broke out again. Even Hal, my boy, he cried in a shaking voice, 16 years old. I have caught him looking at her in a way that made me shiver.
I know the woman, said Madame Story quietly. He put his hand gratefully over hers. I knew you'd understand. What could I do by myself? I have no wife to back me up. I was helpless in such a situation, yet I couldn't stand by and see my child's happiness wrecked. So I sent for you. But what can I do? She said, smiling. Get rid of this woman. Get her away from here. But how? The only thing I can suggest is money. Both Mrs. Dean and her father are recklessly extravagant. She gets nothing from either of her former husbands. O'Malley makes great sums, but spends it faster than it comes in. He can't give her anything. Buy her off. I put no limit on the figure.
Have you considered the difficulties? She asked gravely.
I know the difficulties, he answered, but I know you, too.
I'll do my best, she said simply, but I must warn you that success or failure depends on a factor that is entirely out of my control.
What's that?
How deeply is Layla Dean in love with Wynne Bucknell?
Love? Bah! Cried the general disgustedly. That woman has wrecked the lives of 2 good men that I know of. Such a harpy is incapable of love.
My dear ma'am, said Madame Story, no living woman is incapable of it. The Mickle Island Club provided a subtropical paradise for its millionaire members. All the most expensive amusements known to mankind were to be had there. The clubhouse was built in the style of an old plantation house, with wide verandas and spreading wings. It stood in the middle of clipped lawns shaded by venerable live oaks, hung with moss. Farther off was the near jungle, lavishly stocked with game. Inside the clubhouse was a dream of casual luxury. Roughing it, luxury, if you get the idea. Madame Story and I were given chintz-upholstered bedrooms and sitting rooms at the end of one wing, carpets as springy as turf underfoot, corpulent overstuffed chairs filled with cushions, beds that received you with a benediction. All this must have had a double charm,
after a strenuous day's hunting in the jungle or tussles with the big fish at sea. But there was little happiness or ease amongst the members then stopping at the club, nor did they take advantage of the hunting and fishing, too busy watching each other, apparently. You could feel the strain in every one of them. Whilst I was changing into sports clothes in my room, I heard somebody moving about on the other side of the wall. Suddenly, the door from the hall into the next room was opened, and a young voice exclaimed in a tone of horror, "Elsie!" There was a sharp, low-voiced exchange of speech, of which I could make out nothing, then the sound of a slight struggle, followed by a soft burst of weeping, very painful to hear. Somebody ran away down the hall. I looked out of my door and saw the back of a girlish figure that I knew must be that of Elsie Southam. There were no further sounds from the next room. A moment or two later, Madame Story joined me, and I told her what I had overheard. She listened without comment. When we started down the hall, the door of the room next to mine was open, and we saw the pale and agitated figure of a young boy standing inside, a handsome blonde boy just on the threshold of manhood. There was a look of agonized indecision about him. His effort to conceal it at the sight of us was pathetic. He knew Madame Story as his father's friend and attempted to welcome her cordially, but his tongue stumbled over the words, and the hand that he put out to her was shaking. She made believe not to see anything amiss. "Well, Hal," she said, "it's a pleasant surprise to find you here." "Yes, yes," he stuttered. "I had a touch of flu after the Christmas holidays, and Dad took me out of school. But I shall have to work like the dickens to make up for it later." He laughed nervously. "Mickle Island ought to be a paradise for you," said Madame Story, looking around the room. There was a long table on each side, set out with shallow glass-topped boxes, containing butterflies, beetles, and other insects, all impaled on pins and neatly labeled. "Yes," he said with his nervous laugh, "there's plenty to keep me busy here." "Hal is an entomologist," my employer went on, turning to me. "Oh, by the way, I must introduce you to—" She brought me forward. "This is my friend, Bella Brickley, Hal. This is Hal Southam." The touch of the boy's cold, moist hand gave me the shivers. Madame Story bent over a case of exquisite, shimmering blue butterflies. Next to it were some lustrous, coppery ones. "How lovely," she murmured. "Ah, oh, the Lycaenidae, they're common enough." "Common enough," he said. He pointed to a striped beauty in another case. "But here's a real find, one of the Urania moths. Nobody has ever reported it farther north than Cuba before." "Its parents must have been mighty flyers," said Madame Story. She went round from case to case asking questions. If her object was to put the boy at his ease, it was not very successful. He talked glibly enough about the things that were so familiar to him, but the gone look in his blue eyes had no part in what he was saying. Such a sensitive and manly-looking lad, you couldn't help but feel drawn to him. Madame Story finally turned from the cases. "Well, I must go and pay my devoir to the others," she said lightly. "I'm so anxious to meet Mrs. Dean. I've heard such a lot about her." The boy lowered his eyes with the instinctive secretness of the young. "Yes, Mrs. Dean," he said with a twisted smile. "Is she as beautiful as they say?" asked Madame Story. "Very beautiful," he answered in a smothered voice. "And your sister," Madame Story went on. "I haven't seen her since her sub-deb days. I expect she is a good deal changed." He turned his back on us and made believe to busy himself with one of the butterfly cases. The glass lid rattled when he raised it. He made no answer. "We used to be such pals," said Madame Story. "I hope you will be pals with her again," he said in a low voice without turning around. "She's at a disadvantage amongst us men. She needs a woman friend, older than herself."
"Doesn't she hit it off with Mrs. Dean?" asked Madame Story lightly. It seemed cruel to probe the boy like this, but it was obviously necessary.
"Not really," he muttered, "though she makes believe to."
"It's a shame they had to butt in here," said Madame Story.
The boy did not answer her directly, but I saw him pick up one of those long pins that he used for fixing his insects and press it so hard into the wooden top of the table that it doubled under his fingers. In his mind, he had somebody that he hated under that pin. Presently, he said without turning around,
"You mustn't mind if Elsie seems to act rather strangely. Girls are funny. They seem to get all tied up with themselves, fight with their best friends. It's such a rotten shame that people can't be natural and open when things go wrong."
"Oh, I shan't be put off with her highty-tighty ways," said Madame Story, smiling. "It isn't so long since I was a girl like that myself. I know them."
Hal flashed a look of eager gratitude at her.
"I think it's a darn good thing that you came," he muttered.
There was a slight sound at the door, and turning, I saw Elsie Southam standing there, a blonde and graceful girl, pathetically young and gallant in her white sports suit. She had got the better of her tears and was glancing suspiciously from one to another of us, as if she guessed that we were talking about her. When she found herself under observation, her eyes became bright and glassy, and an artificial smile fixed itself on her face. She ran effusively to Madame Story.
"Darling Rosica," she cried, embracing her, "how perfectly ripping to have you here!"
She rattled on desperately, as if determined to prevent one simple natural word from being spoken.
"What a good time we shall have! There's so much to do here. Tennis, golf, swimming, riding. And do you hunt, Rosica? My dear, I've become a really good shot. Isn't it thrilling?"
My employer was not deceived by all this. Her look was tender as she flung an arm around the unhappy girl and pressed her close.
"I'm afraid I'm not much of a sportswoman," she said, laughing. "What I like is to sit down in the sun and invite my soul."
Elsie petulantly drew herself away.
"Oh, talk," she said with a toss of her blonde head. "That gets you nowhere."
"But you and I have got such a lot of time to make up," Madame Story protested good-humoredly.
2 whole years. We'll have to start and make friends all over again."
A look of fear came into the girl's eyes, very painful to see. She felt that if she let herself go, she would break down altogether. She rattled away like a savage, beating the tom-tom to scare off evil spirits.
"We'll go fishing right after lunch. The guides say that conditions will be exactly right this afternoon. Supper on the beach when we come back. The servants have got up a quartet, and they sing divinely. Or we'll dance if you'd rather."
"Elsie," said Madame Story softly. The girl whirled away.
"Come on, the men are waiting for us in the lounge."
We walked down the corridor together. The lounge was an immense low-ceilinged room in the center of the building, finished in a make-believe rough style and decorated in brown and burnt orange. There was a row of French windows open to the sea breeze, and a wide, shallow stairway starting up at the back and dividing to the right and the left halfway up. When we reached the two men, Elsie was clinging to Madame Story's arm and chattering away. General Southam's face cleared when he saw it. Being only a man, he could not see that the girl's false friendliness would be harder for my employer to break down than open hostility. The boy Hal hung on the outskirts of the group with a harassed, downcast face. I looked with interest at the famous Wynne Bucknell.
He was quite as good-looking as people said, but there was nothing of the male beauty about him, a fine, hard, masculine type with strength and capacity in every line of him. He looked older than his years. His flannels and sport shirt open at the throat set off his fine physique to advantage. But things were clearly all askew with him, too. He looked savage. Elsie made the introductions in a gay and slightly too high-pitched voice.
"This is our old friend, Rosika Story. Everybody knows her, so you had better be careful how you behave now. Nothing escapes her. And this is Miss Brickley. Allow me to present Wynne Bucknell, the Nonpareil."
The man was polite and no more. However, Madame Story was quite undisturbed.
"So this is what you're like," she said. "A sort of myth has grown up around you, you know. And I was anxious to see you for myself."
"A perfect paragon," cried Elsie with a brittle laugh. "So handsome and clever and all that, take it from me. He far exceeds all the stories that are told about him."
We all laughed, but the girl's fleering words made us feel uncomfortable. I saw Wynne's dark face flush. He started to make a sharp retort, but held it in. His shoulders rose slightly, as much as to say, "Oh, what the hell," or "I reckon it's coming to me." He looked stony, but if I am any judge of human nature, he was as sore and hurt inside as the girl. A bad business all around. General Southam endeavored to pour a little oil on the troubled waters by suggesting that we walk around the grounds until lunchtime. "The azaleas are at the top of their form," he said. The perverse girl hung back. Flinging herself into a chair before the empty fireplace, she said,
"You go along, I'm tired."
Hal looked at her with rising fear in his eyes.
"I won't go," he stammered in embarrassed boy fashion. "I have some specimens to fix."
Brother and sister exchanged a look that startled me. Almost hatred, you would have said. Yet Madame Story had told me that they were devoted to each other. It was a kind of silent duel that they were fighting. Hal, boy though he was, got the upper hand, and it was the girl's eyes that trailed away, while her fingers beat a nervous tattoo on the arm of the chair. The other four of us started rather awkwardly for the door. Nobody wanted to go and look at the flowers. Elsie, still with the object of wounding, called out,
"You'd better wait for Layla. She'll be down directly. I'm sure poor Wynne doesn't want to be dragged away."
Wynne turned paler than before, and his jaw muscles stood out as he clenched his teeth in helpless anger. He said nothing. The forms of politeness were too strong for us. We couldn't very well say, "Damn, Layla," so we stood around waiting for her and making banal conversation. In a little while, a drawling voice with a hint of mockery floated down.
"Hello, everybody."
I looked up, and there she stood on the landing of the stairs, dark, slender, and perfect in a dress of pale amber. The first sight of her took my breath away, rather. She was so beautiful that your first impulse was simply to adore. Later you perceived that this perfect shell was entirely soulless. But it was too late then. She had you with her beauty. That woman was bad right through, and she didn't care whether you knew it or not. She trusted to her beauty to get by. In the minds of very simple people, there is a touching belief that beauty must be good. And Layla Dean never lacked for friends. Throughout her most disreputable adventures, she always found defenders. But she ruined everybody with whom she came in contact. She came down the rest of the stairs very slowly, a step at a time, in order to give us plenty of time to admire her. Her dark hair had red lights in it, and her brown eyes seemed to be flecked with fire also. Her skin, I've never seen such a skin. had the lovely, half-translucent quality of alabaster. Such a woman doesn't need makeup, and all she used, or I should say all that showed, was her scarlet lipstick. Elsie was nearest the foot of the stairs. She did not get up from her chair. Layla leaned over the back of it and drew her hand caressingly over the blonde curls. "Morning, darling," she murmured with hateful sweetness. From the depths of the chair, Elsie answered her, "Morning, darling." What else could she do? I was glad that I could not see the girl's face at that moment. Hal stood near. Lila passed him with an infinitely seductive sidelong glance and murmured, "Morning, handsome boy." The boy turned red and then very pale again, and I saw the look in his eyes that had so scared his father. He could have killed the woman with voluptuous pleasure. He didn't understand his own feelings. Layla floated in our direction. She did not look at Wynne nor speak to him. She slipped her arm under General Southam's and, pressing it, turned up her smiling, seductive face. "How's my dear general this morning?" He changed color, but I could see that he returned the pressure of her arm. He retained it under his own. She had put her spell on him, too. He answered, conscious that he must appear a fool under Madame Story's cool and smiling gaze. "I don't need to ask how you are." He introduced us to the beauty. The moment she and Madame Story came together, the delicate sparks began to fly. It was pretty to watch. In my employer, the all-conquering Layla had met just a little more than her match. "Madame Story," she gushed, "this is a pleasure. I've heard so much about you." "And I about you," returned my employer with the frank smile that is such a dangerous trap for fools. Layla shrugged delicately. "Oh, I'm afraid people say horrid things about me," she murmured. "Oh, quite," said Madame Story blandly. This was not what Layla expected. She looked blank. "You don't care, do you?" asked Madame Story. "Oh, certainly not," said Layla. "Gossip only reflects on the gossipers." "Quite," said Madame Story. "What I have always admired in you was the frank and fearless way in which you set out to live your own life, regardless of other people." Layla smiled thinly. She, who liked to pose as the misunderstood, did not relish being cast in the role of the hardy sinner. "You mustn't believe all you hear about me," she murmured. "Don't tell me I'm mistaken in you," protested Madame Story with pretended concern. "Why, you are one of my heroines. I do so admire the way you get by with it." "I never can." "Get by with what?" asked Layla a little waspishly. "Sin," said Madame Story with a delightful smile. "What do you mean by sin?" demanded Layla. "Oh, all the things that timid people would like to do and don't dare," answered Madame Story with a wave of the hand. "You are so witty," murmured Layla with an oversweet smile. "I'm much too stupid to match you." Madame Story's clear gaze dwelt on her lovely. "You are not stupid at all," she said. "You know exactly what you are doing." Layla did not answer her. Instead, she pressed the general's arm and smiled up at him. "What's the program for this morning?" she asked.
"We were just starting out to see the azaleas," he said. "Will you come?"
"Delighted."
When Elsie heard that, she jumped up with perfect inconsistency, saying, "I'll come too." She came towards us with an unhappy, half-childlike self-conscious air that made my heart ache.
"Good," said her father.
At that, the devil came into Layla. I could see it in the corners of her eyes.
"Oh, I'm sorry," she said. "I forgot. Then I had a date with Wynne to go walking before lunch.
Wynne started. I am certain that was the first time he had heard of any such date. Indeed, the protest was on his lips when Layla shut him off by saying, "You know, we fixed it up while we were dancing last night."
"We can all go together," he said sullenly.
"No," said Layla with a slight emphasis. "There is something particular that I want to tell you. We can join the others later."
There was a pause, and I had a sort of breathless sense that the whole situation depended on the outcome. Layla was looking at Wynne with a peculiar smile, testing out her power over him. Elsie's eyes were lowered. I wondered why Madame Story didn't take a hand in the matter, but she had her own notions as to how it should be handled. There was a struggle going on in Wynne. He was no weakling, but the woman's hooks were sunk in him.
"Oh, all right," he said with a sullen shrug.
The two of them went off together through the rear door of the lounge. Elsie, without a word, turned and walked away towards the corridor, holding her head high, game to the end. But I guessed that as soon as she was out of sight, there would be a piteous breakdown. Hal followed her down the corridor. The other three of us turned out through the front door. The azaleas had become poisonous to us.
"Oh, damn him,"
muttered General Southam savagely. "He isn't worth it."
"Can you blame him? Honestly?" asked Madame Story quietly.
"No," he said miserably. "I suppose if she'd crooked her finger to me, I would have gone, old as I am. That woman is a devil."
"She hasn't got him yet," said Madame Story cheerfully. "Overconfidence will destroy her in the end."
Join me next week for part two of The Scent of Almonds on The Locked Room. Until then, beware of footsteps in the dark.